KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. House Republicans approved a massive budget bill that bolsters President Trump's domestic agenda. The measure extends tax cuts and revamps immigration policy. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The Trump administration has officially accepted a luxury jetliner from Qatar. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. What will it take to make it secure enough for a U.S. president to use as Air Force One? It's been almost 5 years since a Minneapolis police officer killed George Floyd, setting off days of protest and destruction near the 3rd Police Precinct. What that neighborhood looks like today through the eyes of its former police chief. It is Thursday, May 22nd. Happy birthday to supermodel Naomi Campbell. She's 55 years old today. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The U.S. Supreme Court has unexpectedly released a decision today. In an evenly divided opinion, it will not allow the state of Oklahoma to set up a publicly funded religious charter school. The tie vote means that the court upheld the Oklahoma State Supreme Court. That state court also ruled against the religious charter school. The U.S. Supreme Court vote was tied because Justice Amy Coney Barrett had recused herself. The House has passed a multi-trillion-dollar government spending bill by a single Republican vote. President Trump helped persuade Republicans who did not like potential cuts to social services or its effect on government red ink. The bill now goes to the Senate, where it faces more doubters. NPR's Maria Aspen explains this budget bill significantly increases the deficit.
President Trump and his party are trying to pass a budget bill that would include tax cuts. Tax cuts means less revenue coming in, and that will make it even harder for the government to reduce the deficit. And then on Friday, Moody's downgraded the United States. It specifically cited the rise in the national deficit, and it said that it doesn't expect the Republicans' budget proposals to create what it called material reductions.
NPR's Maria Aspen reporting. Police in Washington, D.C. say that two staffers at the Israeli embassy were shot and killed last night as they left an event at a Jewish museum. D.C. police say they have arrested a suspect who chanted Free Palestine when he was in handcuffs. U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi says authorities believe the suspect acted alone. European countries are condemning Israel after its military fired warning shots near a group of foreign diplomats in the occupied West Bank. The incident comes as the European Union is reevaluating its ties with Israel over its expanded military offensive in Gaza. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv.
A group of diplomats, mostly from Europe, were on a tour of the Palestinian city of Jenin to observe the results of an Israeli military operation that has emptied the Jenin refugee camp of its residents. Israeli soldiers opened fire, sending the diplomats running for cover. No one was wounded. The Israeli military said the diplomats strayed from an approved route and soldiers fired warning shots in the air to, quote, distance them away. Several European countries said they're summoning Israel's ambassadors. The EU's foreign policy chief called it unacceptable. Israel is facing new pressure from European allies over its intensified offensive in Gaza and limits on humanitarian aid. The EU is reviewing its trade agreement with Israel. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Authorities in San Diego say a light twin-engine jet crashed into a city neighborhood overnight in dense fog. It set homes and cars on fire. It's unclear if there are injuries. It's not known who was aboard the plane. Responders say jet fuel is covering several blocks. You're listening to NPR News. The ACLU says detained activist Mahmoud Khalil will be allowed to have a visit with his wife, but apparently not his newborn baby, whom he has never met. Khalil, a former Columbia University graduate student and permanent legal U.S. resident, is being detained in Louisiana. The Trump administration wants to deport him. His lawyers say that's for peaceful activism calling for an end to the war in Gaza. Investigators say a fire that burned down a historic black church in Memphis was arson. The landmark church served as headquarters for the sanitation workers' strike in the 1960s that brought Martin Luther King Jr. to Memphis, where he was assassinated. NPR's Kristen Wright reports authorities are looking for a person of interest.
The Memphis Fire Department released surveillance pictures of someone they think was involved with the arson. Church leaders at Claiborne Temple say in a statement they're heartbroken to confirm what they knew, that last month's fire was not an accident. Flames gutted the 130-year-old church, where in 1968, black sanitation workers and marchers organized, not only for wages, but also dignity. The campaign's iconic I Am a Man signs were made in the basement. Dr. King came to Memphis to support the striking workers and delivered his final speech at the nearby Mason Temple. Claiborne Temple closed for many years and was undergoing a major renovation before the arson. Church leaders vow to rebuild. Kristen Wright, NPR News.
The upcoming Memorial Day weekend is the unofficial start of summer, but forecasters say a powerful nor'easter is headed for the northeastern part of the U.S. The rare storm may bring heavy rain. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts, and the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin, coming to you from Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul, Minnesota.
I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. House Republicans have approved a massive bill at the heart of President Trump's domestic agenda. Here's House Speaker Mike Johnson ahead of the vote this morning.
This is a historic moment that we will be talking to our children and our grandchildren about, and everyone will remember. America's back.
The bill would, among other things, extend President Trump's 2017 tax cuts before they expire at the end of the year and revamp immigration policy.
And if NPR's congressional correspondent, Claudia Grisales, has been following this. Claudia, how do we get to this place? Because there have been long negotiations and debates that went through the night.
Exactly, all through the night, and they just passed this massive tax and spending plan. It's quite the turnaround from just a few hours ago. They overcame a series of hurdles overnight, from GOP holdouts to fierce objections from Democrats, pushing this plan out of a House Rules Committee hearing that lasted more than 20 hours and a key procedural floor vote before the final passage. President Trump and House Speaker Mike Johnson may have pulled off what we've seen several times this year, another 1-2 punch of GOP holdouts, and to get them back in line. These fiscal conservatives or members of the House Freedom Caucus flipped to yes after an hours-long White House meeting with President Trump and Johnson yesterday, and in the end, it passed by just one vote.
Wow, by a whisker. All right, so yes. After this meeting, Republican leaders released an updated version of this plan. What's different about it now?
Right. They made tweaks to this plan to address concerns from holdouts that it could raise the deficit. But we should know this. We should note this big bill kept a lot of its big provisions in place, such as extending the Trump tax plan, as we mentioned, major policy changes on immigration and energy, and campaign promises that Trump made, like no tax on tips. It also includes a major win for GOP supporters to raise the cap on state and local tax deductions. But those final tweaks to the bill to win over these holdouts included moving up new work requirements for Medicaid to next year and phasing out some energy tax credits. These changes, along with plans Johnson said would involve future presidential executive orders, got momentum back in leadership's favor.
Now, Democrats did try to delay the plan.
Right. Unlike House Freedom Caucus members, however, Democrats don't have much influence here. However, they slowed down the process as much as possible. That included leading a series of fiery arguments on the floor, raising concerns about plans to install these new Medicaid cuts that look to jeopardize coverage for millions of Americans.
All right. So Speaker Johnson wants to get this bill on track to the Senate by Memorial Day. What has to happen now?
So, right, this is a major step, but it is still a very long way to go to getting this to President Trump's desk, as Senate Republicans already have raised plenty of concerns about this bill. Senate Majority Leader John Thune is going to face a tough task threading the needle between this House plan and concerns from his own members. That includes fiscal hawks in that chamber, as well as moderates who have concerns about those Medicaid cuts. So they've already made clear they plan to make a lot of changes to this House bill.
That's NPR's Claudia Grisales. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Economists have been warning that President Trump's trade policy could lead to a recession. The administration's decision to pause most tariffs for 90 days and solid job market numbers tamped down those fears for a time. But now those fears have returned. Moody's downgraded the U.S. credit rating last week, and Congress is in the midst of budget negotiations that could add trillions to the national debt over the next decade. This has led to a sell-off of U.S. bonds, long considered a safe investment. So what does all this mean about the state of the economy? We're going to ask economist Jason Furman. He is a professor at Harvard, and he served as chair of the Council of Economic Advisors in the Obama administration. Good morning, Professor Furman. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with your sense of the health of the U.S. economy right now. What indicators are you looking at?
You know, so far, the real data, when you look at how many jobs there are, how much people are spending, that's quite good. When you look at people's plans and the plans that businesses have for the future, that's really quite bad.
So let me just ask you, sort of, we've been talking about the budget negotiations in Congress, and of course, we've been covering the president's, you know, trade policy all along. So how much of the current uncertainty in the economy is a result of the president's trade policy, specifically tariffs? And then, of course, I want to ask you about those budget negotiations as well. So take the trade policy first.
Yeah. So we have had uncertainty, and economists have different ways of measuring it, at basically record levels, higher than during the financial crisis, higher than during COVID. That's come down some, but it remains very high. That's been almost entirely about trade. And last week, President Trump said that within a few weeks, he's going to re-announce the higher so-called reciprocal tariffs. People were very hopeful we'd reach a lot of trade deals. We did reach a deal with the UK, but deals with every other country have so far proved elusive.
And what about the budget negotiations in Congress? How are economists viewing those?
You know, to me, the worry there is more medium and long term. And that's really quite serious. So I don't want to belittle it. But things like this tend not to push you into recession in the way that the wild swings in tariff rates really risked a recession, especially if we had kept the higher tariff rates on. What things like this adding trillions of dollars to the debt do is they raise interest rates, they raise mortgage rates, they slow economic growth, but all of that plays out generally, historically, over a longer time scale.
So based on what we've just been talking about, how concerned are you about the risks of a possible recession? And if you can, if you feel comfortable with this, what would your timeline be for that analysis?
So, you know, recession is a binary thing. You either have one or you don't. I like to think of the economy more on a continuum. So, you know, if your temperature is 99.4 degrees, you probably have to go to school or work, but you're probably feeling pretty lousy. And that looks like we're on the equivalent of something more like that, maybe something like a 1% growth rate this year. That's not a full-blown recession. That's not a historic crisis that we'll remember. But that's basically every family having, you know, something like $2,000 less because of the combination of all of these. Moreover, coming out of it, we never fully get that back unless the trade policy returns to normal and we start to get our debt under control. So that just compounds over time. All that said, huge amount of uncertainty around what I just said.
So, you know, before we let you go, look, obviously how you look at all this depends on your situation, right? If you're close to retirement, if you're trying to get a job or maybe try to get a better job, or if you're trying to buy a house. So it's very hard for you to give kind of one size fits all advice. But do you have some general words of wisdom for people who are worried about the economy right now, both in the near term and in maybe, say, the medium term?
Right. I mean, some things will affect everyone. You know, if you buy coffee, bananas, tea, just about anything, that's going to go up in price. When it comes to your retirement, you know, we've seen the stock market go up and down depending on what the president does. And when it comes to jobs, for most people, their jobs should be okay. But asking more certainty from the government would give everyone more certainty.
That is Jason Furman. He's an economist and professor at Harvard. He also served as chair of the Council of Economic Advisors in the Obama administration. Professor Furman, thank you so much for your time and these insights.
Thanks for having me.
Extra, extra, hear all about it. Have we got some news for you? The state of New York is doing away with allowing kids as young as 11 to deliver newspapers.
Like Newsies?
Kind of like that. Those kids on their bikes tossing freshly printed newspapers on the doorsteps in the early morning. Now, Newsies started delivering papers as early as 1833. That's according to the nonprofit Poynter Institute. Today, there are fewer papers to deliver as local publications scale back due to falling advertising revenue and also the prevalence of online news. The Local News Initiative reported last year that overall circulation has decreased by more than 60% since 2005.
Okay, so let's look back at this classic youth job.
I just had inky fingers basically for 2 years straight.
That's Mary Snyder. She is now a senior writer with On Milwaukee.
In the 1980s, 12-year-old Snyder and her friend were the only paper girls on the block delivering the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel both after school and on Sundays.
It was a 7-day-a-week job because 6 days a week, you had the afternoon paper, but then we also had the Sunday morning paper was the Journal. So on Sunday mornings is when we had to get up at 4:30 in the morning, sub the papers, and, you know, go deliver them.
Snyder says she made $20 a week.
Don Espanol's experience was a little more relaxed in Williams, West Virginia.
I was able to deliver any time of the day that I wanted. As long as someone got the paper that day, it was fine.
Now a developer for IT business apps, delivering papers was the first time he felt like a working person.
Right. I mean, yeah, having a paper route, a huge responsibility. You handle receipt books, hold bags of cash, sell subscriptions, and accomplish a set task every day.
Alicia Modestino is an expert in youth employment at Northeastern University.
It turns out when you talk to young people or survey them, one of the things that they develop over the summer, in addition to soft skills, is really good work habits.
But with a decline of iconic jobs, such as having a paper route, how are kids getting work experience after school and in the summer? Modestino says retail and restaurant jobs are popular among teens today, and many are even looking at jobs that can help them developmentally.
It's very common for young people to be doing overnight camps or internships or volunteering, other kinds of things that look good on a college resume.
So one chapter closes, another one opens, but don't forget babysitting. That's still around. This is NPR News. Go.
On the next Fresh Air, Walton Goggins. He's the face behind some of TV and film's most complex characters. He joins us to reflect on this moment of rising popularity in his long career and how his unconventional childhood and experiences growing up in poverty have shaped his approach to acting, from Justified to The Righteous Gemstones. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits, at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. The Trump administration has officially accepted a Boeing 747 as a gift from Qatar. The Air Force says the luxury jet will be upgraded to use as a new Air Force One for President Trump. And Trump says converting the plane will be quick, but experts say it could take years and hundreds of millions of dollars to complete. For more, we're joined by NPR's Kat Lonsdorf, who's been following this. So, Kat, can you remind us how we even got here to begin with?
Yeah, so it came out earlier this month that Qatar's leaders had offered the plane as a gift to President Trump. This was just before his trip to the Middle East. That offer set off a firestorm of criticism. Watchdog groups say it violates the Constitution, which bans presidents from getting gifts from foreign governments. There are also legal, political, and security concerns. But Trump said he'd be, quote, stupid not to accept the plane. The backdrop of all of this is that the current Air Force One planes are more than 30 years old, and they do need an upgrade. Trump cut a deal with Boeing in his first term to do that. Those new Boeing planes were supposed to be finished last year, but now it's looking like it'll take several more years. So this gift is a different way to make a new Air Force One happen. It just is not clear if it would realistically be any faster or any cheaper.
So, okay, so we know that Air Force One is just not an ordinary plane. There's a lot more that goes into that than what we would normally fly. I mean, what kind of upgrades are we talking about?
Right. So there are a lot of changes that this jetliner from Qatar would need to be able to do the job of Air Force One. Trump says those changes could be done quickly, like you said, but that doesn't seem very likely. I talked to Ken Walsh. He's a journalist who wrote a book about Air Force One, and he's ridden on it more than 200 times. He told me Trump's plan sounded like a, quote, interesting dream.
Anybody who knows anything about these planes and the history of Air Force One knows that these are difficult to construct. They don't just show up at your airport. They have to be built.
You know, the Air Force One that's in use right now has high-tech communications and defense systems. You know, it can shoot down surface-to-air missiles and withstand a nuclear blast. Here's Doug Berkey. He's the executive director of the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies.
It's a mobile White House. All the functions of the president have to be executed in it, no matter what the circumstances, including warfare.
He said that the plane from Qatar probably looks better than the current Air Force One. It's more luxurious, but it's unlikely it has any of these necessary systems. And installing them takes a lot of time. You have to basically deconstruct the plane to put them in. And you know, the other layer to all of this is that this plane is from a foreign country, a country we haven't always been on the best terms with. And security experts say the plane should be completely stripped to make sure there are no listening devices inside.
Sure. Okay. So all that, everything you just mentioned, I mean, how much is it going to cost?
So most people I've talked to say that it would likely take years to get the plane ready, and lots of money, hundreds of millions to possibly even $1 billion. Trump calls it a free gift, but all this upgrading is almost certainly going to cost taxpayer money. One way it could cost less time and money would be if Trump decided to roll back the security and tech requirements for Air Force One, which he could do. Here's Doug Berkey again.
Ultimately, the government owns the requirements, but it comes down to the risk they want to accept.
So basically, if the government decided that having the plane ready faster was more important than having all the security or all the communication capabilities, it could potentially be ready on the timeline President Trump wants.
All right. That's NPR's Kat Lonsdorf. Kat, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
Authorities have now captured a fifth inmate who escaped from New Orleans' largest jail late last week. As the search for the remaining escapees continues, local leaders are facing the fallout from the security failure. Matt Bloom with member station WWNO has this report.
At an emergency city council meeting this week, Orleans Parish Sheriff Susan Hudson appeared in uniform to face a barrage of questions. In her opening remarks, she called the jailbreak unacceptable.
As your sheriff, I take full accountability for this failure, and it is my responsibility to make sure it is addressed with urgency and transparency.
10 inmates escaped just after midnight last Friday, and it wasn't until after a routine check around 6:45 a.m. that morning that any staff noticed. Councilman J.P. Morrell asked Hudson why it took another 3 hours after that to notify other law enforcement agencies.
That's just weird. You guys should be lockstep when something like this occurs.
So when we have to search this facility with 1,400 people in it, 24 pods, that takes a minute to be able to do.
After her comments, Sheriff Hudson said on social media that she's suspending her reelection campaign. Her term ends in May of next year. A state lawmaker is calling on her to resign immediately. Meanwhile, state police arrested a janitor and two people they say helped the inmates escape and hide. Two deputies are under investigation for possible involvement as well. Over 200 agents are still looking for the remaining escapees. They're getting help from controversial facial recognition technology that relies on a private network of cameras. It helped them catch and arrest at least one of the inmates. The 5,000 cameras are run by a nonprofit called Project NOLA. They entered all the faces of the escapees. Brian Lagarde runs Project NOLA.
It just took literally a fraction of a second for them to look up towards the camera. And then the automation within that, probably that same second, the alerts went out.
Those alerts go to the Louisiana State Police and the FBI, but not to New Orleans police. That's because a 3-year-old city ordinance limits the use of the technology. The ACLU says facial recognition by law enforcement raises privacy concerns and can lead to wrongful arrests. The escapees who were caught so far are being held at the state prison in Angola and face additional charges. For NPR News, I'm Matt Bloom in New Orleans.
So, Michelle, I know that you are in Minneapolis to kind of just see what people are feeling 5 years since George Floyd's murder. What do you got coming up this week?
Yes, we've been here all week, and tomorrow we'll be bringing you a conversation with the mayor, who was, of course, mayor 5 years ago. We'll ask him what's changed and what hasn't. We also will take you to George Floyd Square, which is the scene of where George Floyd was killed. It's become a living memorial, and of course, there's this debate about what should happen to that space. It's still a place of memory, a place of feeling, a place of sort of deep emotion. Even in the midst of kind of this dreary weather that we're having, people are still gathering there. And we'll talk to the very well-known civil rights lawyer, Ben Crump, who represented the family of George Floyd. So it's been a very rich week, and we have a lot more to tell you. This is NPR News.
Rico Nasty is known for blending hip-hop and punk, but she felt industry pressure to conform for years. Now, she's with a new label and feels freer than ever.
Being able to be with a team that allows me to be vocal, and anytime that I get to scream, I'm just having a blast.
I'm Juana Summers, my conversation with Rico Nasty on her new album, Lethal. That's on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Republican leadership led by Speaker Mike Johnson is taking a victory lap. President Trump's budget agenda overcame internal GOP divisions to narrowly pass the House this morning.
The timetable is important. We also have the debt ceiling approaching. We've got the relief that the people need, and
And the sooner they feel that relief, the better. So we did our job, rolled up our sleeves, got it done. We're really proud of that.
The deep spending cuts in the bill include those to Medicaid and food assistance, on which millions of Americans rely. The bill also extends the 2017 tax cuts and boosts border security resources. The House bill would raise the nation's debt limit by $4 trillion. Israel's pushing ahead with more military strikes in Gaza as its Palestinian residents confront a still limited flow of humanitarian aid and the threat of famine. The UN Children's Agency says more than 9,000 children have been treated for malnutrition this year. The Supreme Court's deadlocked on whether religious schools can constitutionally receive taxpayer money through state charter school programs. The 4-4 Supreme Court ruling today left in place a lower court decision that blocked Oklahoma from opening the nation's first religious charter school. Justice Amy Coney Barrett recused herself from the case without explanation. She did so presumably because of indirect ties to the Catholic school that sought charter status. The Dow is down 30 points. You're listening to NPR News. A small plane crashed in San Diego this morning. Police say everyone on board the aircraft was killed. Assistant Fire Department Chief Dan Eddy describes the emergency response when the plane went down in a residential area.
Multiple houses and cars on fire. We had reports of a plane that had crashed in the neighborhood. It was unknown whether it was a military or a private plane. When they got on scene, they initiated quick attack of the fire.
Authorities say no one on the ground was hurt. The Trump administration is proposing a 55% cut in National Science Foundation funding. Northwest Public Broadcasting's Lauren Patterson sat in on a virtual press conference with U.S. senators and science leaders on how that could affect the country.
Senators Maria Cantwell of Washington and Chris Van Hollen of Maryland led the virtual news conference with scientific leaders from around the country. They talked about how the slash of funds could affect U.S. industry. Cantwell says the big ones are aerospace, AI, and quantum research.
We are in an age where there are several areas of U.S. competitiveness that depend on continued science innovation.
The senators noted that Google and ChatGPT both started with some kind of National Science Foundation support. Cantwell says more than 1,500 NSF grants have been terminated since January, totaling more than $1 billion. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Patterson in Pullman, Washington.
I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from your part-time controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Good morning. Of all the people who have reason to reflect on the murder of George Floyd and the events that followed, Madera Arradondo is surely among them. He was in his third year serving as police chief in Minneapolis and the first black chief as well, when one of his officers killed Floyd by kneeling on his neck for more than 9 minutes. The killing set off a wave of protests all over the country and many parts of the world, some of which caused hundreds of millions of dollars in property damage in the Twin Cities alone. He's just published a book titled Chief Rondo, as he's still known, with his take on the events of 5 years ago. So on a cold, rainy morning this week, we rode over to the neighborhood near what was Minneapolis's 3rd Police Precinct, and we asked him to come along.
We are right now in South Minneapolis. We are on Lake Street, and this has always been historically, dating back 100 years, Lake Street has really been our thriving commercial corridor. So everything from our Latino small businesses, East African small businesses, Southeast Asian small businesses, even as a child growing up in South Minneapolis, you know, Lake Street was the place that we went to shop and socialize.
So where was this in the events of May of 2020?
It factored in significantly, Michelle, because where we're at right now, we are right in front of the Hennepin County Library, but a block just to the west of us is the 3rd Precinct. This was the precinct that the 4 officers that were involved in Mr. Floyd's murder, that's where they were based out of.
Okay,
the 3rd precinct.
So let's go over there. Seatbelts.
And you'll just take a left?
You know, I still see some boarded up buildings, and I still see some evidence of burning. Is that from?
Yeah.
2020?
That is from
May
2020.
Of 2020.
And when you see these open, fenced-in lots with either grass or asphalt, that's where buildings used to stand. But they were all destroyed with the fires. The 3rd precinct is obviously right to the left at the light right there. That is the
third precinct
here. This is the site where thousands of people amassed during that week, commencing May 25th, 2020.
There was a pivotal moment
in
the book and in your life that took place here. And this is where you made the decision, where you basically told the mayor that you had made the decision to withdraw.
Yes.
Can you take us back to that and tell us what went into that decision?
Yes. So by Wednesday for sure, this place, the 3rd precinct, became the focal point for both peaceful demonstrations and people who were, quite frankly, they were angry. And I knew that we were facing something that we had never faced before. The crowds are just becoming massive. In the thousands, along Lake Street here, the Target to the right, that was looted and employees were barricading themselves in there. The AutoZone, which has been rebuilt, that went up in flames. There was a Minnehaha liquor store right across from the front of the precinct. That was looted and folks are standing on top of the building there throwing Molotov cocktails. And we had a small contingency of officers inside and I'm hearing their intermittent radio transmissions, Michelle, and over the radio, they're breaching, they're coming in.
Just in a squad car?
I was in my unmarked SUV.
So
watching,
The point came when you had to call the mayor and say, "I can't."
I can no longer, as your chief, I can no longer keep our city safe. And that wasn't the only place where things were occurring. It's happening all over the city, and so I made the call to the mayor. And I said, I can no longer, as your chief, keep this city safe. We need the National Guard in here ASAP. And if you could reach back out to Governor Walz to get them to deploy.
I think some people look back on this now and think the police shouldn't have withdrawn, that they allowed sort of chaos to reign. What are they missing from your perspective?
Well, the first thing I will tell you is that there is a bronze plaque in the office lobby in downtown City Hall in the chief's office. And that bronze plaque has about 48 names on that plaque. And those are all officers that have been killed in the line of duty since the inception of this department. I was fortunate, Michelle, that I did not have to ever add a name to that. And I will tell you, if those officers would have been directed to hold that precinct at all costs, there would have been funerals. There would have been officers' funerals, and there would have been civilian funerals.
So from your perspective, yes, property was lost, but lives were saved.
Absolutely.
And that's your North Star.
That's my North Star. And that became my number one goal. There was no playbook, Michelle, for this in the country. When you're leading in crisis and you have to literally make life or death decisions, I will always lean towards life.
How do you feel about that moment now, 5 years later?
5 years later to get those officers out of this building, it was the right decision.
And how do you feel about what transpired? Because now you see, we still see there are vacant lots. We see a lot of businesses that were destroyed that never came back.
Yeah.
People's livelihoods were destroyed, a lot of people's personal effects. How do you feel about it now?
So one, when I look back on it, I don't believe all of that pain and anger was just about Mr. Floyd's murder. I believe it was generations of people who had either dealt with trauma, who had experienced bad things by Minneapolis police or policing in general in our country. And so I think it ignited that flame. And it's going to take a while for this city to get back. But the worst thing we can do is dismiss this as some sort of anomaly. That is the worst thing we can do. And so I hope we learn from this.
Your book is very interesting. You ended in a really interesting way. You ended with a letter to George Floyd's daughter.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask about that. Why did you end it this way?
I ended the story because I don't think that I can tell that story without acknowledging Gianna. Although I've never had an opportunity, Michelle, to meet her, to tell her I'm sorry, I needed to let her know that while I wasn't there at the scene when her dad was taken from her, I heard him. Mm. And I want her to know that there is hope in the world.
Do you want to read a little bit of it for me?
Sure. Gianna, I believe adults everywhere have an obligation to all our children to never remain silent when we witness harm against humanity. To remain silent means we are complicit, so we must act. Gianna, I promise you that I will do all I can during the time I'm given to make this world a better place for you. With love and a promise, Chief Rondo.
Chief, thanks for talking
to me. Thank you so
very
much.
Very great to meet you. That was the former chief of the Minneapolis Police, Madera Arredondo. His new book is titled Chief Rondo, Securing Justice for the Murder of George Floyd.
This is NPR News.
Beaches are littered with plastic. Along the shores of Lake Michigan, researchers are deploying high-tech dune buggies to try to scoop up some of that trash. Next time on Here and Now.
Big news stories don't always break on your schedule. But with the NPR app, news, culture, and podcasts are ready when you want them. In your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. A Canadian woman was browsing in a thrift store when a gold locket caught her eye. It was shaped like a heart and it opened to reveal black and white pictures of a couple. The woman thought it may have been donated by mistake, so she bought it and posted it on social media, where it eventually ended up with the couple's granddaughter. She recognized the photos immediately. The two women met up. Isn't clear how the locket got to the thrift store, but now it's back where it belongs. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. The leaders of big retail chain stores are uneasy to talk publicly about the high cost of tariffs. At stake is the possibility of upsetting the White House or even their shoppers. So can major chains such as Target, Walmart, and Home Depot eat the costs of tariffs without increasing prices? NPR's Alina Selyuk has been following this. So what are these companies saying, Alina?
Hello, hello. So we are, just as background, we're in the season of financial reports. So companies tend to publicly address what's happening to their bottom lines, and tariffs this season loom very large. Every other question from Wall Street analysts is, you know, what are you going to do about tariffs? What are you going to do about tariff costs? And will you pass them on to shoppers? And this week, we saw companies try to walk a narrow line. You have Home Depot and Lowe's saying they don't plan to broadly raise prices. Or you have Target actually lowering its financial forecast for the year in part because of tariff uncertainty. But then CEO Brian Cornell says this.
We have many levers to use in mitigating the impact of tariffs. And price is the very last resort.
So he says price is the very last resort. He says his team is, quote, hard at work to offset the vast majority of new tariff costs.
Wow, price is the last resort. I wasn't expecting to hear that. Okay, we mentioned the political pressure on retailers. What are they afraid of?
Well, they don't want to find themselves in Walmart's shoes. Last week, Walmart got called out by Trump by name after executives said higher tariffs will lead to higher prices as soon as this month. This was a pretty direct comment from the world's largest retailer. You know, this is a chain that has lots of muscle to pressure suppliers. It puts laser focus on keeping prices low for its shoppers. Many of its shoppers are often on a budget. An executive said Walmart is absorbing some tariff costs, so are its suppliers. But the chain says it will start losing money if it absorbs the full weight of the tariffs. So it's passing on those costs to shoppers. And this prompted a direct attack from President Trump. He wrote an online post to say Walmart should stop blaming tariffs and, in fact, should, quote, eat the tariffs. He also added China should eat some tariffs, but just to say the basics, the way the system works, it's American businesses that import the goods that get the tariff bill.
All right, so what do you think will really happen to prices? I mean, how are store chains adjusting to tariffs?
Yeah, well, I think higher prices are coming, but the scale will depend on the store and the item. So right now, companies face a 10% tariff on all imports and a 30% tariff on imports from China, thanks to a temporary deal. That could go way up higher in a few weeks. We don't really know. So retailers are keeping all their options open. Take Home Depot. The chain said no broad price increases are in the plans, but individual products may go up in price. Some product options may simply disappear from the shelves if tariffs are too much. Stores are trying to buy less stuff made in China. They are trying to get consumers to buy American-made, although those items tend to cost a lot more than imported options. They are switching some products with less tariffed alternatives. They're choosing whether to stop selling some stuff completely. As they say, you know, the only constant is change. Maybe that's the takeaway here.
Alina, you hear that? I'm buying my sneakers now. Buying them now before the price goes up.
You haven't done it already?
I've been waiting to see what happens, and now you've told me. So now I'm going to do it. That's NPR's Alina Selyuk. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This is NPR News. Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. A trickle of aid has entered Gaza this morning.
Israel has begun letting in aid trucks this week after its nearly three-month-long total blockade of everything from food to medicine.
The United Nations says a handful of bakeries are now operational in south and central Gaza. And last night, in his first press conference with Israeli journalists in 5 months, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu defended his plan to expand the war.
NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi is with us now with the latest from Tel Aviv. Good morning, Hadil.
Good morning.
So Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu took questions from reporters last night. What did he say about Israel's stepped-up military campaign now in Gaza?
Right, so Netanyahu went through his order for the Israeli military to mobilize this expansion of the war. He reiterated that the plan is to push all Palestinians who are in northern Gaza right now into an area in the south. And then, in fact, the Israeli military issued evacuation orders for the entire northern part of Gaza yesterday. That's at least 100,000 Palestinians right now, according to Gaza first responders. And we need to know, like, the south is almost entirely destroyed because of the 2 years of war. It has very little resources, let alone space to live in. But Netanyahu also said that he is willing to end the war with certain conditions. The hostages come home, Hamas lays down its arms, and we implement the Trump plan, he said. That's Trump's proposal to displace Palestinians out of Gaza fully. Netanyahu called it a brilliant and revolutionary plan. Yesterday, NPR sat down with U.S. Ambassador to Israel Mike Huckabee, and he staunchly defended Israel's sovereign right to conduct the war as they need to. In a statement, Hamas condemned Netanyahu's pledge to Trump's plan, saying it undermined Washington's role as a, quote, mediator. And I'd like to mention the UN's human rights chief said that Israel's plan to force people to move under airstrikes, the methodical destruction of entire neighborhoods, the denial of humanitarian assistance, he said that all of this appears to be a push for a permanent demographic shift in Gaza, and that is against international law, and he said it is, quote, tantamount to ethnic cleansing.
Hadil, what have we heard from Palestinians inside Gaza?
Well, under this major international pressure, Israel finally said it would allow a, quote, minimal amount of aid into Gaza. According to the UN, about 200 trucks entered carrying some critical supplies. That's compared to 600 trucks, which were crossing daily during the January ceasefire. So the UN is really calling this week's development a, quote, drop in the ocean. NPR's Enes Baba met a woman at the malnutrition department of a hospital in Gaza City. Ilham Abdul Hafid was carrying her one-year-old daughter. She can't find milk to feed her baby anymore, so she's been giving her water instead. My daughter is very thin, the mother says. She was in hospital because of malnutrition, hooked up to needles and IVs. I'd cry every day, my heart breaking for her, she said.
So, Hadil, if we could turn to the fatal shooting last night in D.C., what's the reaction that you're hearing in Israel?
There's been a string of condemnation from here. Israeli President Isaac Herzog and the foreign minister are called the shooting despicable and anti-Semitic. The foreign ministry posted a statement saying, quote, may their memory be a blessing. And Netanyahu has said that he's instructed to increase security at Israeli missions around the world.
That is NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi in Tel Aviv. Hadil, thank you.
You're welcome.
As we mentioned earlier, some of us from Morning Edition have been reporting from the Twin Cities this week as we mark 5 years since the police killing of George Floyd. People have died in police encounters before, but this happened in front of many witnesses, some in person, and tens of millions more because of a teenager's cell phone video. One thing that's clear, witnessing Floyd's murder left a deep imprint, and we've asked several people why they think that is. A minister who served at an historic Minneapolis church, Reverend Frenchie McGee, a public health educator at the University of Minnesota, Zinzi Bailey, and lawyer Antonio Romanucci, who represented Donald Williams, a passerby who tried to intervene.
In general, when someone has, you know, emotional distress injuries, they suffer from nightmares, they suffer from flashbacks, they suffer from what are called triggering events if they see anything similarly happen.
It's a situation of collective trauma. What happened to George Floyd is not something that was just a one-off. It's that we have known this to be the case over and over again, especially in Black communities.
George basically narrated his death. He was telling this police officer, Derek Chauvin, "I can't breathe." He didn't say it once or twice. He said it over a dozen times. He said it 20 times.
The fact that it was a joint experience in some ways for a lot of people, for them to also see and join in the horror and in the recognition of tragedy.
There was, at the time, I described it as a really long, very loud existential scream. That's what was occurring as the streets were filling, and in some cases, as the violence was happening. This was the result of a city that just took a long breath and just screamed at the unfairness and the grief.
I had a number of friends who checked in on me. A number of friends who were just like, "Are you okay?" I think it brought a greater sense of community, of being held and being cared for.
That was Associate Professor Zinzi Bailey, Reverend Frenchie McGee, and attorney Antonio Romanucci. Tomorrow, we take you to what's become known as George Floyd Square. That's the intersection where Floyd was killed. It's now a gathering place and memorial filled with flowers, hand-painted signs, and people who come often with loved ones to acknowledge loss and promise change. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez.
Oh.